Collective's Burnout Paradise on November 1st and 2nd at the Nimoy. The award-winning Australian Collective delivers a frenetic, physical, and darkly comedic showdown performed on treadmills. Four performers spiral through escalating tasks, confronting burnout, broken systems, and the struggle to set boundaries. More information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org. Radio powered by the people.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities, are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnestad. It's day 31 of a government shutdown with lawmakers in a gridlock over health care. Democrats wanting to rescind Medicare cuts slated to impact more than 10 million Americans in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act President Trump signed into law. And they want to extend health insurance subsidies set to lapse at the end of the year, impacting some 22 million Americans. Republicans say they can negotiate those deals after funding the government. The government shutdown is having widespread impacts, with some 40 million low-income Americans set to lose SNAP food benefits starting tomorrow. Some two dozen Democratic-led states have sued the administration for not using contingency funding to keep that program afloat during the shutdown, a first in U.S. history. Now a federal judge in Boston Thursday may intervene, saying she's not going to make everyone drop dead from lack of food. President Donald Trump is now urging the Senate to end the filibuster so the Republican majority can pass a budget that will reopen the government without Democratic support. Senate leader Republican John Thune is opposed. New York, Maryland, and Virginia have declared emergencies due to food benefits slated to end. At the nation's capital, Republicans and Democrats are blaming each other for the stalemate. Here's Vice President J.D. Vance and House Minority Leader Democrat Hakeem Jeffries.
We are happy to talk about any policy issue. We're happy to talk about health care policy. We're happy to talk about tax policy. We're happy to talk about regulatory policy, but not at the point of a gun. You do not get to take the American people's government hostage and then demand that we give you everything you want.
Republicans are willing to starve hungry children in this country and take away SNAP benefits starting on November 1st so they can pressure Democrats into gutting the health care of the American people.
Thursday, Democrats defended the demand to extend pandemic-era health insurance subsidies set to expire at the end of the year for some 22 million Americans enrolled in the Affordable Care Act health insurance marketplace. Dahlia Lozier reports.
Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi recalled the passage of the Affordable Care Act, saying the law remains one of the pillars of social policy, alongside Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Of all the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and the most inhuman because it often results in physical death.
Pelosi said Republicans are threatening that legacy by refusing to reopen the government or extend the subsidies, effectively pushing people out of affordable coverage. Republicans argue that Democrats' health subsidies disproportionately benefit undocumented immigrants through state-level programs that use ACA funding, but federal marketplace plans are limited to citizens and lawful residents. Healthcare advocate Laura Packard, the cancer survivor.
My insurance rate is going up about $100 every month, so I'm going to pay over $1,000. I will find a way. I have to because as a cancer survivor, I can't go without health insurance. But too many Americans, millions of Americans, are going to be facing 20%, 50%, 100% increases.
Packard says that even a modest rise in premiums could push many Americans to forego insurance altogether. Shoppers have until January 15th to choose a plan, though those who want coverage beginning January 1st must enroll by December 15th. I'm Dahlia Lozier.
The United Nations human rights chief has condemned the U.S. bombings of boats suspected of drug trafficking in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific Oceans. Volker Turk called the strikes unacceptable and called for an independent investigation into the killings. Colombia's government said one of the boats bombed carried fishermen. The comments come 2 days after War Secretary Pete Hegseth announced the 14th strike on suspected cartels in boats without providing proof. King Charles III has stripped his brother Andrew of his prince title and his home amid mounting pressure to address Andrew's ties to Jeffrey Epstein. Andrew surrendered his Duke of York title earlier this month following new allegations. The family of Virginia Roberts Giuffre, who accused Andrew of sexual abuse in three incidents in her newly released memoir, praised the move and called for further investigation. Illinois advocates have sued federal authorities over alleged inhumane conditions at a Chicago-area immigration facility. The lawsuit today alleges immigrant detainees are being denied their right to access legal counsel, have been denied food, water, hygiene, and medical care. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with new co-host, Nana Jumpy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we peer into the future of New York City with Aimé Castanel and look back on the regime's efforts to disappear people in countries they've never known with Hugo Eze. All this and more on Sojourner Truth, right after this short music break. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with co-host Nana Jumpy. This coming election day, just next week, New Yorkers will likely make history in electing the first Muslim and immigrant mayor of New York City if they vote for Zohran Mamdani. His potential election occurs in the midst of one of New York City's nastiest races, fought with racism and Islamophobia, swimming in billionaire cash of his opponents. So glad to be joined by Aimé Castanel once again to talk about this race and what it bodes for the future of New York and the country. Aimé Castanel is a brilliant writer and the senior digital strategist and digital producer for the Working Families Party. Greetings, Aimé. Thank you for coming back on. Really appreciate you.
No, thank you. I'm happy to be here, as usual, always.
So, it's looking good. It's looking good. It's going to go the way folks are hoping that it goes. Really glad that you could come back and talk about this campaign. Of course, the campaign of Zohran Mamdani, looking at, you know, we talked, it's not really the beginning, but the semi-beginning, let's say close to the beginning, when it was like, oh my gosh, could it be, you know, and it was starry and
all Pisces, you know what I mean? Watery and all kinds of things happening. And now here we are. I mean, we got an election that's happening next week. And, you know, everyone that listens to this is not from New York City, but this has importance across the country. So let's start there, right? Like, why is this so important? This candidacy, this run, the election, drum roll, of Zohra Mamdani as the mayor of New York.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I am not from New York either, nor do I live there anymore. But I can see what I feel like we all see, what we're all feeling, why everybody everywhere is excited about this, is that the fight for this seat isn't just local. It's about the kind of politics that we actually do want in this country. Are we going to let billionaires and corporate Democrats decide who represents us? Or are we going to build a multiracial working class movement that delivers for everyday people? And that's what Zohran stands for. And that's what the Working Families Party is building everywhere. And this entire election shows like the clash between two very different visions for our future. On the one side, you have corporate power and political insiders trying to maintain control, as they do. And on the other side, you have people like Zohran who are leaders who actually come from movement spaces, who fight for tenants, immigrants, and working people. And when someone delivers for their community the way that he does and refuses to bow to big money, it absolutely scares the establishment. And that fear, that tells us everything that we need to know about how powerful we actually are when we organize. And I feel like that hope, that beautiful hope, is why people are paying attention right now to New York City, but also the reason why it's so important for everybody to actually be doing that, to pay attention to it, because we all, I think, need to be reminded that we do have power. Like, it's not just billionaires who get to control everything.
It is certainly not. And you're talking about two sides. I'm like, well, you know, there was a side, there was a side and a half on that side for a moment when that Adams was in there. I'm not quite sure what was happening with him, but he was in there creating chaos as usual, being ridiculous. And now he just is, you know, I'm waiting for him to be appointed by the regime to go somewhere to do horrible things. I'm waiting for that. But looking at the candidates as we see now, the other piece that we're seeing beyond that, on top of, I will say, the billionaire piece, because it's clear that they've thrown their hats in, they've thrown their monies in behind the particular candidate, but also thinking about the racial aspect of this, thinking about the, you know, the religious aspect of this, the way in which that has really come to the forefront in like openly ugly ways during this openly ugly time.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it actually has been really disheartening and disgusting to see just these really base tactics that are coming out because of this fear. Like, they're seeing that people are responding to this message of affordability, shock. Imagine people want to be able to live where they live and afford it. And so the answer for them is not, let's contend with the reality, people's lived reality, but instead, let me strike up fear. Let me drum up these old tropes and be racist all over the place, be xenophobic, be anti-Islam, all the things, in order to create wedges and divides that should not exist and don't actually really exist for real people. They care more about their actual lives than they do about, you know, the boogeyman that doesn't exist next door.
Yeah, and I think that's clear. What I find interesting is that that was their one up. You know, I don't really play cards, but you know, when there's like, okay, you know, I'll see your free buses and I'll raise it, you're a terrorist. You know what I mean? Like, I'm like, how did they think that that was a proper counter or even an effective counter? And I think it really, in some ways, has backfired because maybe they don't know who's in New York City. I think that's also a part of it, too.
Right. They don't live there.
They don't live there. They just pretend to live there because attacking Muslims in New York City is very odd. You know, World Trade Center, notwithstanding, you still have millions of folks who are Muslim in New York City. Like, it's very strange. That, and there are their friends and families and people who love them, such as myself. You know, it's odd to think that that would be something that would work. When we're talking about, just again, when we're talking about Mamdani, we're talking about some of the things he's putting on the table. I've mentioned this free buses that people seem to think is impossible because they're not quite clear what divest invest is. But what are some of the, you know, maybe a few of the other things that he's talked about that has really caught the attention, caught the passion, the fire of the people, particularly working class folks?
Yeah, I think it's like two things. One is that voters are tired of being broke. They're tired of being priced out. They're tired of politics that only works for the wealthy. And so having somebody talk about fighting for affordable housing, childcare, good jobs, it's not extreme. It actually means that you're literally just paying attention to what people have been talking about, the anxieties that people actually have. And I think like Zoran's ideas sound great. And, you know, the opposition wants you to think they're completely unrealistic. Like, it can never happen. How could we do it? But what's unrealistic is actually pretending that we can survive another decade of rent hikes and student debt and climate disasters. His ideas are rooted in reality, like the lived reality of people that people have to deal with every single day. And so the question isn't, are we being too ambitious? Can we do this? It's more, why have we accepted so little for so long? And I think that is really the crux of it all. We can do these things. And if we, especially if we try, but if we don't try, if we give up before we even did anything, then what is even the point? That I think is the reason why people are so energized by this.
And I think it's a lesson, right? I mean, I'm looking at Mamdani, who, you know, isn't quite the mayor yet, but it seems like it's moments away. I'm looking at Mayor Brandon Johnson. And look, when you're talking to me, you're not talking to a person who's like, oh, my God, you know, electoral politics is it and the politicians are going to save us, or that I don't see issues with electeds, even electeds that I think are being really good on a lot of, you know, a lot of the issues that our folks are concerned about. But I do look at a Mayor Brandon Johnson and say, look, you know, what we see there that is energizing the people of Chicago is a person who's saying to this regime, you know what I mean? You know, come get me. I'm here. And Jesus Christ, my Savior, will hopefully say he means to stay saved, right? But
yes. But
it's clearly squaring up, you know, as the Nigerians would say, facing his front, right? This is what's happening. I'm squaring up. I'm going to confront. And I think people see that also in Mamdani, like a person who's willing to square up. And that's what I think people are looking for, right? Yes, of course.
Yeah.
Looking for this world that we want to see, which both of them discuss and talk about, right? But also just looking for folks that are not cooperating and are not cowering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like they're bringing accountability back to the Democratic Party, quite frankly, and building up the idea that like, this is what democracy looks like. We're not trying to divide people. We're here to build a politics that's honest and that's rooted in the people and isn't afraid to tell the truth about power and to power. And, you know, when you lead from that place, like Brandon Johnson is doing, like we're seeing him stand up to Trump, it really does shift the focus and it shifts the narrative to the point where we're not stuck on these like little divisions that the Republican Party wants us to be focused on, like race. But instead, we're looking at the real issues. We're actually seeing, you know, that when we speak to people's real lives, not political labels, not identity politics, we're actually going to win hearts, minds, and elections, because that's what people care about. They aren't left values. They actually are kitchen table values.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is that I'm not even afraid for them to be described as left values, frankly. It's like some people just don't know that they're left. They don't know they have left values. They have been told that the values that are ascribed by the left are some kind of special weird thing that is different than what they care about. They would be so surprised.
Right.
You know, it's like when you talk to people about the capacity to have time off, sick leave, an 8-hour day or less, and that, you know, all of these things that people think are normal and that people literally fight over. It's like, yeah, that's not the work of the billionaires.
Right. If it was up to them, we would be working 24 hours a day.
Absolutely.
But I mean, you
that's not the work of them. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is what's happening because of what, you know, folks have been working on and dealing with. So to turn around now and to try to make it seem as if this is somehow not what you stand for is preposterous.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, people want to say all the time that like this can only happen in a place like New York, a blue city. And it's not true. I mean, when you look at places like Pennsylvania, where Summer Lee won, or Illinois, where Delia Ramirez won, or Georgia, which is where I live, where we helped elect progressive Black women up and down the ballot, genuinely, in the entire state. The truth is that, like, working class people everywhere want the same thing. They want to live with dignity, to afford rent, and to have a say in their future. And that's not a coastal issue. That's absolutely a human one. So, you know, we're seeing that, like, when you do the work, when you organize year-round and lead with values of care and fairness and freedom, people are going to show up to vote because they recognize, you know, they're like, oh yeah, right. No, this is important. We need to be here for this. We need to stand up for ourselves. And we have these people who are willing to show that they are going to speak on it.
Right.
And that's everywhere, not just New York City, not just Chicago.
Right, right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumpy, and I'm speaking with my good friend, comrade, Amy Castanel. We're talking about this election in New York and beyond, right, in terms of where we are on the clock of history as we look at the emerging power of the people when it comes to these elections, in spite of the billionaire dollars that are going into so many. As you know, we think about the election of Mamdani, again, not sure it's happening, but it looks that way based upon these polls. What can we expect from the regime? Like, I've got to believe that he and his team are clear that something's coming at some point. I don't know when he would be inaugurated in. Apologies for that lack of information, but just thinking about, you know, how should we be preparing? What should we be thinking about, both inside and outside of New York City, in terms of support and defense?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's already been threatened, surely, with ways in which the federal government will sort of try and penalize New York City for what they don't want to have happened. And I feel like he's responded pretty clearly with how he plans to manage that, probably in a similar way to what Brandon Johnson is doing, which is within the actual rule of law and not allowing, like, these vague threats to sort of shift his focus from what he's actually talking about, which is the things that people care about, nor the fear that, like, somehow money will be lost because you are trying to help people. Because, you know, we can't trade our values for donor comfort. That's how we literally got here in this mess to begin with. Money doesn't vote ever. And when working people feel seen and supported, they're going to turn out regardless of whatever threats you make. We don't need billionaires to back us. We need to believe in each other. And I feel like that belief is going to carry him through, should he be elected, when he gets elected, hopefully. It'll carry him through to face whatever it is that the government is going to try and bring down. Because we don't know truly what he would try to do, but we do know that there's going to be something. There's going to be some kind of retaliatory action, because this is the way that this man operates. Petty and, quite frankly, corrupt.
Petty and corrupt. Yes, that is two of the middle names for this person who is leading the current regime. What can folks, you know, what should we be looking forward to in terms of what this means, not just in terms of New York, but also what this potentially can mean, you know, across the country? You know, obviously, yeah, Working Families Party has been investing in certain types of folks who are running for office, who are in office. And so what does this say, right? As we are looking at people talking about the duopoly, trying to break the duopoly, trying to see what other things exist, albeit still within the system to some degree that we're operating.
I would say we win when we organize, not when we apologize. So, like, you know, you can't apologize for who you are, what you represent, all these things, but you can organize and show people that what is possible. I also think, like, you know, our politics don't need to be palatable to powerful people. It should be about what's possible for our people. And I think that that's something that we can definitely take away from this campaign. Also, you know, if progress actually scares these billionaires, then that feels like we're on the right track. And that is what we're seeing in city after city, all over the place in this country. And it is a beautiful thing to see. And lastly, I would say that, you know, voters are smarter than consultants give them credit for. And we need to always remember that, because it's not about, like, you know, who has the most money, who has the best friends in power. It should be about the people. And I think, like, these populist campaigns that we're seeing gaining traction, having like such a strong impact across the country, outside of the cities where these people live and are being elected, is something that we all need to be paying attention to, because it means that we're ready. People are ready. They're ready for a new way of doing politics. They're ready for, you know, movements that actually support people, that talk about what people actually care about. And, you know, it's not just one election. It's not just election season. You win if you do this every day, all day, every day. That's like the, you know, impetus of the Working Families Party, is like, we're trying to build this across the country, that the idea that this is the future that we want. We want to see a democracy where people are represented, people feel represented, and feel heard and seen by their elected representatives. Imagine that. But also that people are invested, because they feel like you're pouring into them, and then therefore they're going to pour back into you. And that's how government should be, quite frankly. Like, it should be like a constant conversation between the people who are electing you and the person who's been elected. Not you get elected and now you're the king of everything and you do what you want.
You don't get to be the king of everything. What? What is the point?
Unless you're running for king of everything.
Absolutely ridiculous. But no, truthfully, I mean, I am heartened. I'm seeing some stuff happening in Georgia coming up in some of those elections there. I think there's a lot of these local elections, mm-hmm. including school board elections that are happening across the country. Some of these city council elections that are happening across the country, not just in villages, which some people, you know, kind of associate with having more progressive, too left, too radical people in office, but even in some of these mid to bigger cities, including New York City. And it's good to see. It's really, mm-hmm. really good to see.
Yeah, no, it is delicious. I mean, our job at the WFP is to help elect people who make politics feel possible again, and to remind people that, you know, you can win change when you organize together. And I feel like we're actually getting to do that. And it is beautiful to see.
Beautiful to see. Beautiful, Aunt May. If folks want to follow you and to hear from you, I know that you are writing as well as posting. Please let folks know how to do that.
I am writing. I have a Substack. You can subscribe for free, because I don't believe in making people pay to read what I have thoughts about. But it's just my name, amy.castanel.substack.com. And if you want to know more about the Working Families Party, you can find us at workingfamilies.org. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so very much. Hope to have you back soon,
you
after
know,
our celebration, to celebrate the win. We'll have you back.
Yes. Yes. Let's do it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Aunt May Castanel, Senior Digital Strategist and Digital Producer for the Working Families Party. More with Ugo Eze after this station break.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover, and you're listening to Fiercely Independent, KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and worldwide at kpfk.org. Radio powered by the people.
Morning light, silken dreams take flight as the darkness gives way to the dawn. You survived, now your moment has arrived, now your dream has finally been born. The struggle brings.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth. I'm your co-host, Nana Jumpy. Thanks for being here with us. In light of the regime's escalated efforts to disappear immigrants to countries where they have never lived and have no connections whatsoever, we revisit our conversation with Ugo Eze, legal advocacy manager for the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, also known as BAJI. Greetings, Ugo. So
hey,
glad
Nana.
That you're able to join me.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So we have not talked about third-party agreements, these ways in which this regime is throwing people across the country too much on this show. It's been a minute. And so I want to make sure that we get this back into people's minds as it gets back into the news and hits headlines so that people are understanding what we're talking about and why this is so problematic. So yes. Let's start first with just the basics of what are these third-party agreements as they relate to immigration in the United States?
Absolutely, yeah. So the administration is carrying out a number of third country removals, which are removals or deportations to countries that are willing to receive folks through these third-party agreements. However, they're considered third parties because they're not the person's country of origin. The person is not a citizen there. They're not a permanent resident. And the third-party agreements, these can only be done through bilateral agreements. So the U.S. cannot just send someone to any country. They have to have an agreement with this country where they have said that they are willing to receive folks, and also that they have like provided some assurances on the treatment of these folks when they arrive in these countries. That being said, under U.S. law, third country removals are only supposed to happen when all other options have been considered and all other options are considered impracticable, inadvisable, or impossible. So this is really supposed to be like an absolute last resort. But this is really changing the deportation scene because the Trump administration is like, this is the first resort, basically. And it's a really important to note that this really makes people very vulnerable, especially Black people, especially folks that are not from any region close to the countries that they're being removed to, and other marginalized folks, whether it's because of their sexual identity, their disability or ability status. It really puts them at heightened risk to be dropped off in a country that is not their own.
And I think sometimes when we talk about this, and thank you for that, because I think it's important that people have the basics, that they understand these third party agreements, how they connect with these third country removals, and what the impact of third country removals are. Because I think sometimes when we talk about this, you know, people feel like if you get removed to a country that's, for example, not a country that it seems to be an act of war, right? So let's say it's not Sudan, where people understand there's a war in Sudan.
Right.
Then they feel like, well, what's your issue? You know what I'm saying, Ugo? You know, come on. You meant to want to be here? What's the big deal? You're going to get sent to somewhere else. But if it's not a war country, what's your problem?
That is not the case.
And so how do we get people to understand what it is when you go to another place that you didn't choose to go to, right?
Right.
What can people think about in terms of issues that may arise? Because now you're in some country that's not the country that you came from, true enough, but is not a country that you have chosen to go to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So there's like a number of things that cause issues here. One is that a lot of immigrants that are coming to the U.S. are seeking asylum. And if they're seeking asylum, that means that they are fleeing some sort of persecution because of something about themselves, whether that be their racial identity, their political views, a social group that they belong to, or other things. And so they have chosen to go to a particular country, in this case, the US, because they know that they will not be persecuted on the basis of those things. In the country that they're choosing to go to. And that is also, in a lot of cases, the reason why they are afraid to go back to their country of origin. It's the reason why the US government cannot return them to their country of origin. So if the US government in turn just decides on another country that has no relation to this person, they might still be at risk of being persecuted in that country. And so it's not a solution that is human first.
It's not a solution that's human first. Thank you. That I love the wording. I love the way that you've expressed that, because, you know, I think about the way in which the United States and other so-called Western countries just dump things, you know, like they get things that they don't want to have on them and they just send it, mm-hmm. you know, secondhand clothes. They just go and dump it somewhere. Right. You know, toxins. They just go and dump it somewhere. Trash. They just go and dump it somewhere. And it feels like that. Like, it's like, okay, yes. Well, we've decided that this group of people or these individual people are disposable. And so we really don't care where we dump them. The main issue is that we want to get them out of here.
Yeah. Yeah. And at the end of the day, it's not treating people as human beings, because as much as we, you know, shouldn't be dumping trash or clothes or other things in these other countries, we most definitely should not be dumping human beings in other countries.
Thinking also about the ways in which, to some degree, these third party agreements themselves in this immigration context are mm-hmm. not new. But I think the way in which they're being used here is newer, at least. Right. How are we, you know, what is the difference? Because we, you know, even with Black Alliance for Just Immigration with Baji, we're talking about, you know, the fact that asylum was being exported through these third party agreements. But now we're not talking about just exporting asylum. Talk a little bit about that, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So these third-party agreements aren't completely new. However, the only one that was used with any semblance of regularity, and even that regularity was very rare in the past, was in relation to folks that had passed through Canada on their way to the U.S. to seek asylum. And the rationale there was a bilateral agreement, or there is a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Canada. And the rationale there is that Canada is a safe country for most, in the same way that the U.S. is for most. And so if folks had passed through Canada before coming to the U.S., they would have had to apply for asylum in Canada first. And of course, there were some exceptions to that, like if they were Canadian and they were fleeing Canada or other things. But that's really the only time that has been used with any sense of regularity. That obviously is changing in this administration. And one of the big issues with that is that there has to be, like, as I mentioned earlier with these bilateral agreements, it's not just that a country is willing to receive people. They also are, the U.S. is under obligation to make sure that they are not returning folks to places that would be harmful to them, where they would be persecuted or where they could be tortured and things like that. And the U.S. is whitewashing the human rights records of several countries in order to facilitate these third country removals. We've seen how the Department of State has made a bunch of revisions to their annual human rights reports and has even made special revisions to the reports of certain countries, including like El Salvador and Mexico, and is returning folks to these countries. We saw in the news that this administration returned a lot of people to El Salvador, and they were at Cicote Prison, which is notorious for torture and arbitrary detention. And these are not, you know, human rights issues that just arrived when the U.S. started deporting people there. These are things that have been going on in this country, in El Salvador, for a long time. Same thing with deporting folks to South Sudan, that's, you know, on the brink of a civil war and has a lot of humanitarian crisis. Deporting folks to Rwanda, where there have literally been lots of reports over several decades of disappearances and torture that go on in Rwanda. And so the U.S. is kind of overlooking these things and saying that, oh, yeah, these are safe countries, and then deporting people there, when the fact of the matter is that these countries do not meet the requirements to be eligible for third country removals.
It reminds me about what our mama, Ida B. Wells, peace be unto her, used to say about lynchings. We depend on those who did the lynchings or the ones who write the reports, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like they write the reports and they decide. And then they also use the power of empire, the power that they have to control the countries through their economic power, through the power even of travel, like the travel bans, right? These various mechanisms to try to see how they can lean on folks. I think it's not a surprise that as we start to see countries say, you know, I give, or uncle, maybe Uncle Sam, mm-hmm. you know, that they're going to be connected to countries that are dependent on the U.S. militarily, countries that are dependent on the U.S. economically, countries mm-hmm. that are on the travel ban, countries that are on the I'm still mulling it over travel ban, or have experienced some kind of immigration sanction. We're going to see that happening more and more and more. And, you know, we'll talk in a moment, but it's like we need to figure out how to apply the kind of pressure that makes the other side of the buy in bilateral maybe not as willing to give in. There was a report that Baji did that you worked on that was shared with the special rapporteur. Talk a little bit, please, about that, what the goals were, and what the report really finds.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, a few months ago, this past June, Baji submitted a report to the UN Special Rapporteur on Migration about how the US is externalizing its migration policies. And by externalizing, we mean that the US is expanding its migration policies outside of the interior of the US and beyond the borders of the US and into other countries. And so while Baji rejects, you know, all policies that inhibit people's right to seek safety and their best quality of life, the report focuses really on how the externalization policies are disproportionately negatively impacting Black migrants. And, you know, we see that across policy, that Black folks tend to bear the brunt of these policies. But the report is split into three sections. And the first section talks about the migration trail. So we know that, you know, lots of folks from all over the world, especially in more recent years, folks from all over the world, including, you know, Africa and the Caribbean, have been coming to countries in South America and then making their way north through the migration trail through Central America. And throughout this journey, there are a number of US externalization policies that are negatively impacting Black migrants. Like, for example, there are safe migration offices in countries like Colombia that are supposed to expedite the process of seeking entrance into the U.S. However, they kind of de facto exclude Haitian migrants because of some of the requirements that they have to be able to meet the requirements of the process. There are also, you know, immigration laws that are very racist and restrictive throughout Central America, particularly in Costa Rica and Nicaragua. There are also U.S.-funded military immigration enforcement in Guatemala and El Salvador and in Mexico. So even before they get to the U.S., as folks are traveling north, they're coming into contact with U.S. laws or U.S.-funded policies, U.S.-funded or U.S.-trained soldiers and officers that are making it more difficult for them to continue in their journey and effectively keeping them out of the United States. The second section of the report talks about the use of tech, and it focuses a lot on Mexico. There is a lot of surveillance at both the southern and northern borders of Mexico, and as well as there are several agreements between DHS and Mexico to surveil migrants, to collect their biometric data, to share and store this data without any measure of transparency or regulation. There's agreements also with countries of origin that share personal data of folks as they're coming through. And we know that technology can be racist, both in like how it is actually made. Like, we've heard of Black folks not being recognized on facial recognition technology, but it can also be racist. Tech can also be racist in how it's being used. And that's the case with immigration tech as well. It's being used to criminalize Black folks and kind of feed into this narrative of scary criminal immigrants. And then the last part of the report talks about third country removals and talks about how the Trump administration has literally been breaking the law by holding migrants, for example, in Guantanamo Bay, by holding migrants. We saw that hundreds of migrants were held at a commercial hotel in Panama. They are shipping folks to South Sudan against judges' orders. They had to hold those folks in very inhumane conditions in Djibouti. So there's just no regard for how foreign people, how Black people are treated in these third countries when they're removed. So the goal of the report was kind of to illuminate all these different aspects of U.S. externalization policy, and kind of like how outlandish it is, as well as show how it's impacting Black folks, and then also hopefully create a resource for folks, not just in the U.S., but also in these countries, to kind of come together and collaborate to learn about how their governments are, how the governments are collaborating, right? And how we can push back as folks who, you know, have invested interest in these countries and in our community members through our own local channels and create transnational coalitions. Because if the governments of different countries are working together, the people also need to work together. Like, we need to get on their level and start fighting back.
Yes, we do. Sign me up, Ugo. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. We look at the continent and I'm just horrified and disgusted. We saw this coming to some degree again when we saw the travel bans, etc. It was like, okay, these folks are about to, this regime is about to lean into African countries to get them to agree to be places to send folks in these inhumane, improper, unlawful third country removals. And we see that happening, right? And as you said, starts with South Sudan, then they were held at the military base in Djibouti for a moment, and then sent back to Sudan, South Sudan. It goes to Eswatini, you know, and they're starting in places where people maybe aren't paying so much attention. It's, you know, 8 people here, 4 people there, that kind of thing. Uganda steps up and says, oh, we'll take folks, but, you know, tries to make it look cleaner for its own people by saying, oh, they got to be, you know, we want them to be African people and we want them to not have criminal records. And then Ghana just, you know, luckily I'm not too nationalistic, you know, just decides to somehow turn this abomination into a Pan-African project. And it's like, we're a transit hub, while people who have gotten the Convention Against Torture protections are being picked up and removed, dumped out of this country. Ghana says, don't worry, bring them over here. We will be a transit hub so they can go back to the country with that they were tortured in. What is happening in this moment? You've talked about what's happening with Central America, with parts of South America and Mexico, but what is going on with the continent of Africa right now?
Yes. Yeah, it's really important to note that the Trump administration is not even being shy about how they are pressuring these African countries to take whoever. They have been very transparent. We saw with the most recent travel ban that there were several African countries on the list. And we later on saw that there was a list of several more countries, including several African countries, that were kind of sent an ultimatum of sorts to say, you know, if you don't meet these criteria, you'll also end up on the next travel ban. And one of those criteria was, we need you to accept folks that aren't even from your country that we want to deport. And yeah, the Trump administration has really been going hard to use African countries for third country removals. There was also a mini summit that happened with five African countries that was supposed to be about economics and security. And during that meeting, Trump also was asking folks to accept third country removals, to enter into these bilateral agreements. And so they have really made this, you know, their top priority. And as you mentioned, you know, maybe some of these countries, at least Americans, are not paying that much attention to, but it's really important to see through the blinders of like what is going on here. Like you mentioned Eswatini, how they just, you know, received a few folks. I believe it was five people that they received who were like Asian and Caribbean. They openly said that these folks would be held in solitary confinement in prisons indefinitely. You know, and then Rwanda has also agreed to accept folks. Ghana, as we were mentioning, has said that it will accept anyone from who has ECOWAS citizenship and has openly said that their goal is to repatriate them to their countries of origin. And that's a problem. That's a big problem because, as we mentioned before, yeah, like these folks are fleeing their countries of origin. And so even the idea, the original idea of third country removal that, you know, is not what's going on now, but the original purpose of a third country removal was to help people escape harm. And so the fact that the Trump administration is now entering into bilateral agreements with third countries and it's sending folks there with the open acknowledgement that they will just be repatriating them to their countries of origin is a huge problem. And then also, as we mentioned before, like the whitewashing of these countries' human rights records, like folks are not safe in these countries, especially foreign folks. Are not safe in these countries just because Trump and the president of that country said, came to an agreement and they said, yeah, yeah, we'll take care of them.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's something that we can hopefully talk about on another segment at another time. this increase in the United States, these companies out of the U.S., these companies out of Europe, I'm sure there'll be a few thrown in that are out of Israel, that are prison companies that are working with African governments to do this private public prison hookups, you know. And when I'm talking about hookups, I'm talking about, I recently stayed in a place in Ghana, did not realize that the people that I was seeing as folks who were, you know, kind of cleaning up and doing this and doing that were actually people who were prisoners. They were prisoners, but I was in like a complex, you know, like a shi-shi-sha-sha, you know, type of complex. And it, no shade to the people that were prisoners. I don't have a problem with them. I was so traumatized. I left in the middle of my stay to go somewhere else. Oh, no, you will not be. I will not be benefiting from convict leasing today.
Right.
And so when I start to think about what some of these third country removals can lead to, in terms of what these people could be doing, imprisoned or not, right? What they could be forced to be to go through, even if they are not sent to, you know, as a transit hub, through a transit hub to their home country. It's like, okay, well, if you end up staying in Ghana, you could end up just being someone that's working like in a work camp. Easily.
And Rwanda even said, you know, we're happy to receive folks to contribute to the fastest growing economy in Africa.
You see?
So you want these folks for money, which means you're about to put them to work.
You see? Right. And so some of this externalizing in terms of policies is not just immigration policy, but externalizing some of the domestic policies of prison for profits and all of those things that we see that are happening here. So yes. Much more that could be said, but Ugo, how can we push back? What can we do? Because I know that there are people who are in fear right now, who are detained right now, who, you know, some of those folks are stateless because at the time, for example, the folks who are Eritrean, who at the time Eritrea did not exist, quote unquote, right? And so they're stateless. And so they know they can be sent to a third country and they know that this regime doesn't care where they send them. There are other folks who have been granted various protections and are thinking that, okay, I'm going to be able to get out and are going to find and are finding that no, you're not getting out. Actually, those removal proceedings are continuing and they're looking at sending you to a country that is not your country. And, you know, you may end up in a different country, but either way, or, you know, end up in your home country, but either way, you in danger, girl. So what is it that people can do to try to push back?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's a few different things. I would say for the lawyers, for the attorneys out there, it's really important to keep challenging these things in court. People not only have a right to due process, they have a right to an individual assessment of their immigration case. So this is not a situation where these sweeping policies should be being applied. So it's really important to keep making those challenges. I would say for the folks that are at risk, it's really important to know your rights. As this administration, you know, is expanding enforcement, expanding detention, expanding removal, folks need to know what they can do to best avoid getting swept up in this entire apparatus. You know, you have a right to remain silent. You don't have to adhere to a warrant that is not signed by a judge. Like, it's really important to know those basic rights so that you can avoid ending up in this system. And for other folks, for organizers, activists, researchers, teachers, it's really important to learn what's going on, like to really learn the details of this and get in where you fit in. If you're in a position to teach, you should do that. If you're in a position to protest, you should do that. If you can organize a letter writing campaign or a phone calling campaign to your elected officials, do that. If you're in a position to create coalitions, especially if you're in a position to connect with folks internationally, it's really important that we find spaces that are doing that so that we have a holistic and like transnational approach to just tear this whole thing down.
Tear it down brick by brick. We want it to fall. Thank you so very much, Ugo. Really, really appreciate you. Where do people go if they want to follow Baji, if they want to get to that report that you described earlier to the special rapporteur? Where do they go?
Absolutely. So we are on all the socials, Insta Baji on Instagram, Baji Tweet on, I still call it Twitter, Black Alliance for Just Immigration on Facebook and LinkedIn. Our website is baji.org, B-A-J-I.org. You can find our reports under the resources tab. And on our socials, we post events, information, and opportunities to get involved.
Thank you. Appreciate you so much. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thanks so much, Nana. Have a good one.
That was Ugo Eze, Legal Advocacy Manager for the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. And that's our show. I'd like to thank our guests, the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, D'Angelo, and assistant producer, Gary Scott. Remember to find ways to be well in the midst of it all. One love.
Support comes from the Soraya, presenting Maritza, performing for one night only on November 6th. The acclaimed Portuguese fado singer blends jazz, flamenco, and more into the soulful and poetic nature of traditional Portuguese fado music. Maritza's enchanting charisma and unparalleled voice will take you on a musical journey through the culture and nightlife of Portugal. Further information and tickets are available at thesoraya.org and kpfk.org. Trago um fado no meu canto.